This is CBS News on the Hour, presented by Indeed.com.
I'm Linda Kenyon. Striking writers may be inching toward a deal. CBS's Bradley Blackburn has the story.
The writer's strike started in May, and actors joined in July, with SAG-AFTRA launching its own strike. Together, they have frozen the entertainment industry. For writers, sticking points come down to residual pay, staffing in writers' rooms, and the use of artificial intelligence.
I do hope that I can get back to work and that it's over soon, but only with a fair contract.
These demands look at a world that has changed dramatically over the past decade, an industry that's changed dramatically.
Hollywood insiders say a deal with writers could help pave the way for actors. The Screen Actors Guild has said the studios will not meet with them to negotiate. Bradley Blackburn, CBS News, New York.
The United Auto Workers Union continues its strike against the big three automakers, although there are reports of progress in talks with Ford. WWJ's Kelly Vaughn is following.
In a statement, Ford says that although they're making progress, they still have significant gaps to close. Stellantis says the UAW seems more concerned about pursuing political agendas than negotiating for their employees. And GM says UAW leadership is manipulating the bargaining process for their own agenda.
President Biden plans to join striking auto workers on the picket line on Detroit on Tuesday. The president says if House Republicans can't reach a deal among themselves on a government funding bill, they'll have to take the blame for a government shutdown.
Funding the government is one of those basic responsibilities of Congress. And it's time for Republicans to start doing the job America elected them to do.
The current fiscal year runs out at the end of this week. If Congress doesn't reach a budget deal by then, a government shutdown will follow. Thousands of migrants seeking asylum continue to cross the U.S. southern border, with the most significant numbers coming into Texas. Approximately 2,000 people a day are crossing at El Paso. Emergency Management Chief Jorge Rodriguez says many of them are being bused to other places.
They sign a form stating that they're going voluntarily to the destination of their choice. No one is being forced.
Buses left yesterday for New York City, Chicago, and Denver. A CDC advisory panel is recommending pregnant women get the RSV vaccine.
The panel recommended in an 11-to-1 vote that Pfizer's drug Abrysvo be given during weeks 32 to 36 of pregnancy. The recommendation was formally adopted by CDC Director Dr. Mandy Cohen. RSV is the leading cause of hospitalization among infants, according to the CDC. Anywhere from 58,000 to 80,000 children under the age of 5 are hospitalized with RSV every year in the U.S.
CBS's Matt Piper. This is CBS News.
You need to hire fast and hire right? You need Indeed. Their all-in-one hiring platform helps you attract, interview, and hire candidates efficiently. Visit Indeed.com/credit.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Vice President Kamala Harris will campaign at the University of Wisconsin in Madison early next month. Young voters are expected to have a lot to say about next year's election. Mike Mohn reports.
The Brookings Institution says by the 2028 presidential election, people under the age of 45 will serve as the majority of U.S. voters. At the Alliance for Youth Action, Dakota Hall says young voters want transformational change and won't be satisfied unless there are what he describes as sweeping reforms relating to democracy.
These are folks who went to high school and witnessed nothing but news coverage on their different social media feeds of like dysfunction, of government shutdowns, and then a global pandemic, right? And so they've seen the worst of what this country can be.
For more progressive young voters, nearly 2 in 3 see safeguarding abortion access as a top priority. Those identifying as more conservatives see bringing inflation under control as their top issue. Michael Hayes, a former consultant, says political attitudes and party identification tend to be formalized by young voters in their late teens and early 20s. He adds a family's political values will influence a young person, but also notes political events can also shape their outlook.
Many of them may identify initially as independents, but they lean toward one party or another. But once the attitudes are formed and once people begin to use them in their political behavior and their voting, they tend to firm up pretty consistently.
Meanwhile, Brookings Institution researchers point out that younger Americans are tilting the electoral playing field strongly toward Democrats. This is Mike Mohn for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
More than 80 million Americans depend on AM radio each month for news, weather, and emergency information. A new bill in Congress would make sure AM radio remains in cars. Because when cell and internet services are down, this free service could be your only lifeline. Text AM to 52886 and tell Congress to support the AM Radio for Every Vehicle Act.
Message and data rates may apply. You may receive up to 4 messages a month, and you may text STOP to STOP.
This message furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters.
Pursuing the truth wherever it may lead. The Todd Albaugh Show, weekday afternoons from 1 till 3. Join the conversation. Get involved. The Todd Albaugh Show on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app. 93.5 The Tap. 93.5 The Tap.
Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning. It is Saturday, September 23rd. My name is Jim Santel. This is Morning Cannolis on the broadcast stations of Civic Media. Delighted to have you with me for this hour and hopefully next hour too. 2 full hours this morning, as is the case every Saturday morning. This is our weekly review, our analysis, and our discussion of the most important news stories in law, in government, and the aspiration for justice in America. We're coming to you this morning, as always, from the Civic Media studios here in downtown Waukesha. But we're broadcasting throughout the state of Wisconsin, always, always inviting your questions, your thoughts, your comments, your perspectives on the subject matter of the day, which we'll review in just a couple of moments. The phone call can come in through our studio here through my wonderful producer, Anya. And that number is 844-967-2789. In addition to calling in, we also have the option for you to send me and Anya a text. Go on to the media online web, Civic Media online website, pull down your broadcast station, find Morning Cannolis, and send us a text once again about your questions, your comments, your perspectives, or your views on the subject matter of this morning. As always, we ask those three important questions here on Morning Cannolis. What happened? What do we know about the things that are occurring in our world, in our nation, in our community? Why are those things important? Why are they relevant? Why are they material to understanding our lives and our livelihoods? And what, if anything, can we, should we be doing about those things? What actions should we be taking? What responses, what answers should we be giving? As always, we've got an ambitious but achievable agenda this morning and a syllabus that hopefully will both inform you and perhaps even inspire you somewhat. And before we get to that, an outline of what we're going to be talking about this hour and next hour as well, a couple of programming notes this morning. One having to do with next Saturday's broadcast, live once again from the Civic Media Studios right here in downtown Waukesha, going out to the Civic Media broadcast stations throughout the state of Wisconsin. We're going to begin next week our review of Supreme Court cases. Yes, that's right. In about 10, 11 short days from now, the United States Supreme Court is going to begin to entertain oral arguments in what right now is about 23 cases already pending before the United States Supreme Court. First Monday in October, always understood to be the start of the new term of the United States Supreme Court. No exception this year, the 2023-2024 term about to begin. We're going to begin to talk about some of the cases on the docket of the Supreme Court beginning next Saturday, September 30th. I'm going to make reference to one of those cases today in connection with some updated Supreme Court news from just yesterday. And then beyond that, on Saturday, October 21st, we're going to be coming to you live from the broadcast stations of Civic Media, that in downtown Madison, the Civic Media station in Madison, a special outreach to our Madison area listeners, and of course, all of you throughout the state of Wisconsin. Take note of both of those. Again, next Saturday, all things Supreme Court, and on the 21st of October, as we get into those topics in greater detail, broadcasting live from Madison and the station there. What is our syllabus about this morning, September 23rd of 2023? We're going to talk first about some undiscovered justice items, one of them coming out of Brazil, going overseas, actually to the Southern Hemisphere for a while, talking about a significant event in Brazil, talking about a Fourth Circuit case involving transgender rights. Again, undiscovered justice. And finally, something having to do with guns in America. Typically not a basis for extolling justice, but nonetheless a movement in the right direction in which we attempt to address our significant firearms issue, an issue that has taken the lives of 31,000 people already in this calendar year 2023. Then beyond that, we do a couple of rule of law snapshots. What's going on in Alabama with that case with respect to the gerrymandering and line drawing in that state? I'm going to talk a little bit about the Bill Paxton, Attorney General Paxton situation in Texas, the acquittal a week ago today, and what's yet ahead for the Attorney General there in that state. And then, as I promised, we're going to chat somewhat about the Supreme Court. We've got new news coming out of the Supreme Court once again, focusing on the ethics and the income and the benefits gotten from one of our Supreme Court justices, his name Clarence Thomas, that coming out just yesterday. We'll talk a little bit more about where that stands, where an ethics code stands in America, what the future may hold for that. And speaking specifically about the reason why this issue, this news of just yesterday is so important in connection with a case coming up before the United States Supreme Court in this term. Necessarily talking beyond all of this about the indictment also released just late this week of sitting Senator Bob Menendez from New Jersey. We'll talk all about that, why it's important to understand that, and the significance once again for promoting the rule of law across party lines, the nonpartisan, apolitical approach of the Department of Justice, regardless of who you are, required to follow the law in this nation. We'll chat more about an indictment, what that means, and what Bob Menendez and his wife and others in that indictment are currently pending. Also coming out of Capitol Hill just this past week, some major testimony by our United States Attorney General. His name, of course, Merrick Garland. We'll talk about some of the exchanges between him and members of the House Judiciary Committee that invited him up to Capitol Hill to talk about the significant things that should be going on in the Department of Justice. We'll chat about whether or not they really achieved that syllabus, or rather talked about politics and attempts simply to attack and not support the rule of law in America. Finally, as promised last week, we're going to go back to the federal indictment that's pending against the former president of the United States of America, this indictment charging him with four counts related to the attempt, not successful, but the attempt nonetheless, to undermine, to overthrow, to compromise your votes, the votes of the other states in the union, the Electoral College votes on January 6th, before and after. I'm going to chat more today about the continuing effort at that time in January of 2021 to try to undermine that process through the Department of Justice, especially animated by one of the unindicted co-conspirators in that matter, his name Jeffrey Clark. We began to talk about that at the end of last Saturday's broadcast. We'll get back to that this week. And then also talk once again about the fake electors, the false electors throughout the country, seven different states, including right here in Wisconsin. What's the status of those false electors in Georgia and in Michigan, where they have indeed been charged? Not all of them, but many of them in Georgia, virtually all of them in Michigan. And what does Wisconsin look like? What is the status of that? What kinds of things are available to our attorney general here in this state to charge the false electors not yet charged coming out of the state of Wisconsin? Lots of different things to observe this morning. And then also, of course, we're on the cusp, perhaps, of yet another shutdown in the United States government. I want to spend some time permitting, talking about why that, too, is a rule of law issue, why it goes not just to government and law in America, but also affects our understanding of the delivery of justice, the connection between what could happen in one short week, that is the failure of the United States Congress to put together an agenda for our budget in the coming year. We have not had an actual budget in the United States of America for over two decades. And I'm going to spend some time talking about why that is significant, the consequences of that for the rule of law, and the ways in which the continuing impasse again, apparently, in Washington this week, this weekend, even as members of the House of Representatives head home yesterday and today for a weekend of being back in their districts, not attending to this all-important work in Washington, D.C., that could compromise not just the function of government, but the ways in which we think, once again, about the law and the delivery of justice in America. Lots and lots and lots of things to discuss in this hour and then also next hour as well. Delighted to have you with me this morning to talk about all those things. And once again, our phone number is, of course, 844-967-2789. Also available to take your texts, your written comments through the Civic Media website. Delighted to have your comments, as always. Let's talk about some undiscovered justice, since many of our discussion topics this morning are going to be very serious and very challenging. Let's talk about some good things that have happened just this past week in this country and, yes, to a country to our south. Some reasons to celebrate justice and the rule of law in America and also in one of our allies to the south. That ally is Brazil. Brazil, this past Thursday, indigenous peoples in the nation of Brazil were celebrating. Why were they celebrating? Why? Because the Brazil Supreme Court on Thursday enshrined their rights, resolved a case that enshrined their land rights, removing an imminent threat that was being posed to the land rights that the indigenous peoples there in that nation had that were otherwise going to be rolled back. The justices have been evaluating in that case, again, in the nation's capital there in Brazil, a case brought by the Santa Catarina state. It was backed by farmers, and they were seeking to block an indigenous group from expanding the size of their territorial historical heritage claims to property there in Brazil. Nearly all of the high court's justices voted just this past week to support the indigenous groups, and that, of course, has far-reaching implications for territories not just the subject of that lawsuit, but also nationwide. One of the responders, one of the people who was there at the time of the Supreme Court's decision, said, "I'm shaking. It took a while, but we did it. It's very beautiful and a strong feeling. Our ancestors are present, no doubt about it." That a spokesman for one of the indigenous groups was a part of this litigation, a major piece of litigation, understanding the heritage there in Brazil, sending a message also to all of us here in the United States of America and throughout the world. Areas occupied by indigenous people and areas that are linked to the ancestry and tradition of indigenous peoples have constitutional protection, the Supreme Court wrote, even if they are not specifically demarcated, even if they're not specifically lined out. You can't look to a map and identify them with great specificity. They're still there. Two justices who voted to support the Santa Catarina position on the opposite side were appointed by President Jair Bolsonaro, who was, of course, a vocal opponent of expanding indigenous territories and supported their assimilation. Their assimilation, an issue with which we have had, regrettably, a great deal of history here in this country. That lawsuit put at risk the status of Brazil's hundreds of indigenous populations and in the territories that they claimed as a part of their history. And the group, among others, that proclaimed great victory here today is called the Portuguese Peoples of Brazil, an acronym APIB. Large groups responding to that from different states throughout the nation, celebrating this focus on the heritage of that nation, sending a message to all of us about what we should do here in our nation, also acknowledging our history and the things yet to come. Stay with us for more discussion of undiscovered justice here this morning on Morning Cannolis.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Cripes Cast with Charlie Behrens.
Today, I am talking to the owner of Funky Fresh Spring Rolls, my friend Truman McGee. From an environmentally friendly perspective, the fact that it's frozen means that it's not going to waste.
I am a serial strawberry abuser. If you're a fruit and you're watching this, stay away from me, okay? Do not jump in my shopping cart because I will let you die.
Cripes Cast every Saturday and Sunday at noon across Civic Media and on the Civic Media app.
If I could be you.
And you could be me.
For just 1 hour.
If you could find a way.
To get inside.
Each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out. And for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Your home for local news, weather, and sports across the airwaves and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
Back here on Morning Cannolis, talking about some stories called Undiscovered Justice, a special presentation this morning about things in our land and in places to our south. Discussing right before the break this major decision by the Supreme Court in Brazil, finding that indigenous populations there do have ancestral and present rights to lands there. One of the executive coordinators for one of the groups who's advocating for that said, "We've won the battle, but not the war. We will continue to fight for indigenous territories to be demarcated." In other words, identifying what additional properties out there the indigenous populations in Brazil have a legal claim to. So the rights of indigenous peoples are safeguarded and protected. Something, of course, that we need to be heeding here in the United States of America as well, especially at this time when we would try as we best we can to embrace the importance, the significance, the benefits of diversity, both looking forward but also understanding our own history. Let's come back to the United States of America here and another significant piece of undiscovered justice this past week, not a part of the major headlines in America, but a federal appeals court just this past week now considering and has before it decisions to make about some cases coming out of North Carolina and also West Virginia that could have significant implications on what? On whether individual states are required to cover health care for transgender people with government-sponsored insurance. It's a lot to consume. The issue whether individual states, again, including some in the federal appeals districts, the circuit in the Fourth Circuit, are required to cover health care for transgender people with government-sponsored insurance. Richmond-based Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals heard oral arguments just this past Thursday involving the coverage of gender-affirming care by North Carolina's state employee health plan. And also in addition to that, these two cases combined, the coverage of gender-affirming surgery by West Virginia Medicaid, that is the program that also provides that health care. During the course of the proceedings, of course, at least two of the judges on this broad panel so it's very likely this case will eventually reach the United States Supreme Court, and it may well, given the focus, the importance of these cases. Both states, North Carolina and West Virginia, had appealed separate lower court rulings that found that the denial of gender-affirming care was discriminatory and unconstitutional. The states objecting to that finding. And two panels of this Fourth Circuit set of judges heard arguments in both cases earlier this year, we're attempting to resolve those, decided to bring them all together. And yes, indeed, just this past week, the full court, the entire panel of judges on the Fourth Circuit heard these all-important arguments. Attorneys for the state of North Carolina said that the state-sponsored plan is not required to cover this gender-affirming hormone therapy or surgery. Why? According to the state of North Carolina, because transgender status is not an illness, the attorney argued. Also went on to claim that that the matters that are the subject of this lawsuit, the subset of transgender people who suffer from gender dysphoria, a diagnosis of distress, over gender identity doesn't match a person's assigned sex, that also, that's only a subset of the folks out there who can make claims. And for that reason, too, arguing that that state-sponsored plan is not required to cover this gender-affirming care. Significant arguments to make. The Court of Appeals, of course, all 15 of them now looking at this. June of 2022, a North Carolina trial court demanded the state plan pay for medically necessary services, including hormone therapy and some surgeries for transgender employees and their children. The judge had ruled in favor of the employees and their defendants as well, and said that in a 2019 lawsuit, they were denied coverage for gender-affirming care under the plan unlawfully. That was the lower court ruling. The North Carolina State Insurance Plan provides medical coverage for more than 750,000 teachers and state employees and retirees and lawmakers and their dependents. And it provides counseling for gender dysphoria and other diagnosed medical conditions. It does not explicitly cover treatment in connection with sex changes or modifications in related care, also the subject of the oral argument just this past week. In August of 2022, another federal judge had ruled that West Virginia's Medicaid program must provide coverage as well for this gender-affirming care for transgender residents. All of that happening again in the Fourth Circuit. Significant when we think once again about the importance of recognizing that everyone in our nation has a right to health care, and especially at a time when the LGBT community is a subject of not only a lot of attention and a lot of focus, but also a lot of attacks around this country. And an important case coming out of the Fourth Circuit, we'll monitor that to see what the Fourth Circuit says, hopefully affirming the lower courts that found that the decisions by the state to limit the coverage under these plans was unconstitutional, illegal, and should be affirmed. Health care being extended to all members of our LGBT community, including our transgendered colleagues, our citizens, our residents in those states, and presumably, ultimately, other states throughout our nation. More undiscovered justice just this past week. And finally, let's talk about a very serious issue as well, also in that bucket of things that concern us dramatically in our nation. And it has to do with guns, but this time a response to our gun problem that may ultimately provide some significant ways forward. We know from just a couple of weeks ago that something called the National Center for Education Statistics, the NCES, did an annual crime and safety report issuance. And they said in particular the number of school shootings in the United States just hit a record high. There were 188 shootings with casualties at public and private elementary schools during the 2021-2022 school year, according to this annual crime data just released. About two-thirds of them caused injuries. 57 led to deaths among our school children. Second year in a row, the number of shootings with casualties hit this all-time high peak in American schools. It's more than twice as many casualty-involved shootings than recorded just last year. Last year's figure, 93, was the highest in two decades. We have now exceeded that. And, of course, as I indicated at the top of the show, something in excess of 30,000, almost 31,000 people in America killed as a result of gun violence in our nation. So what happened? What happened this past week? Well, again, we're still waiting for the Congress to address this issue. But the President of the United States of America announced something very significant in this continuing battle to regain control over violence and to stop the kinds of things that we're witnessing on a regular basis. When we come back, I'll tell you what the President of the United States of America did, what the Vice President is going to be working on as we go forward on this morning's broadcast.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
CBS News Brief. Striking writers may be nearing an agreement. Jonathan Handel is an entertainment attorney.
There is worker activism at all levels in this country that is a result of the widening gap, the widening income and wealth inequality in this country.
Auto workers are still on strike. Sean Fain is the head of the UAW.
We invite and encourage everyone who supports our cause to join us on the picket line. From our friends and families all the way up to the President of the United States.
The President is planning to join the picket lines in Detroit on Tuesday. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg tells CNN it's up to House Republicans to shift into high gear on a government funding bill.
The American people don't want to shut down. From what I can tell, the Senate is ready to go. The administration is ready to go. House Republicans need to come to their senses and keep the government running.
The current fiscal year ends on the 30th. CBS News Brief. I'm Linda Kenyon.
Attorney Joe Cordell.
Business owners and professionals face special challenges in divorce court. In addition to everything else going on, they have to contend with allegations that they are earning more than they are, coupled with claims on their business or practice itself. Clients with assets depend on their divorce lawyer's skills in these matters, and that's why it's so important to hire someone that has those skills.
Schedule an appointment with one of Cordell & Cordell's Madison area attorneys. 8040 Excelsior Drive, Suite 403, Madison, Wisconsin, 53717.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous, as in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org, brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUS Kids, and the Ad Council.
When you're high, you feel different. You think different, you talk different, you draw different, you listen to music different. You probably knew that. Problem is, you also drive different, and not in a good way. That's why driving high is illegal everywhere. So if you're high, just don't drive. Make a plan to get a sober ride. Because if you feel different, you drive different. Brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
93.5, The Tap.
Back in our Saturday morning broadcast, talking about some stories not in the major headlines this past week, and therefore called Undiscovered Justice, discussing the continuing challenge, the continuing horrific challenge faced by all of us in America at the, quite literally at the receiving end of firearms in America. This past week, the White House, from the President of the United States of America, Joe Biden, announced plans for the creation of the first White House plan, the first White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. The president said this in particular. He said, I'll continue to urge Congress to take common sense actions that the majority of Americans support, like enacting universal background checks and banning assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, things he has advocated for, things we've talked about a lot on this broadcast, things that we know work to try to address the horrific violence that is on the receiving end, that is the caused by guns in America and people using them in those ways. But he said this, but in the absence of that sorely needed legislative action, the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, along with the rest of my administration, will continue to do everything it can to combat the epidemic of gun violence that's tearing our families, our communities, and our country apart. The office apparently will play a key role in implementing what's called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, which is a 2022 law. You may recall that. We talked about that. One of the most sweeping gun violence prevention measures in about 30 years did not accomplish some of these major things, these major policy changes that we know will affect, will reduce the incidence of injuries and deaths as a result of guns. Congress passed that legislation after a gunman massacred about 19 people, students and two teachers at the Uvalde Elementary School. You recall that very well. The White House announcement comes weeks after the Biden administration proposed rules that would require, in addition to all of this, for-profit firearms dealers to obtain a federal license and conduct criminal background checks as well. He's also taken some other actions, some executive actions in recent months, all of this designed in the absence of legislative history to make some attempts through the White House, through the executive branch, to address this problem. The president plainly frustrated by the failure of the Congress, failure of the people of the United States of America to come forward and get this accomplished, even though the great majority of people in our nation support all of these remedies. Our Congress needs to listen to the people of our nation, make those things happen. In the meantime, the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, commissioned by our president to try to identify other mechanisms, other means of addressing this horrific problem in our midst. All of those things, undiscovered justice in America just this past week or so. A couple of rule of law snapshots before we get to some of the major issues of the morning. Let us talk first about what is happening once again in Alabama. You may recall, well, we have spent a lot of time talking about this major voting rights case coming out of the Supreme Court just this past summer. Supreme Court, to the surprise of many people, after issuing a number of decisions in recent years that seemingly and do in fact compromise the Voting Rights Act in some significant ways. Earlier last summer, issued this ruling in a major voting rights case coming out of Alabama when it affirmed in a 5-4 decision the protections of the Voting Rights Act, its fundamental tenets, its fundamental principles, having to do with Alabama. What happened in Alabama? Once again, Alabama, this state with 7 congressional districts, a lower court, a 3-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit, that's important, remember that, had directed that the legislature redo the maps, redraw the lines that they had drawn previously, ensuring that there were at least 2 of those 7 districts were majority black districts to ensure that people of color in the Alabama state have an opportunity to elect people of their choice, directing that 2 of those 7 be majority black districts. The case went up to the United States Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court very definitively, again, to the surprise of many people, said, Alabama, you've got to do exactly what the lower court has said. You are in violation of the Voting Rights Act by disenfranchising people of color in that state, in your state that you represent, and directed them to do just that. Came back to the Alabama legislature. A couple of weeks later, the Alabama legislature stunningly says to the Supreme Court, we're not doing that. And they drew a new map, revised the map from its earlier rendition, if you will, and failed to create a second majority black district as the United States Supreme Court had directed. They decreased the percentage of black voters in one of the existing majority black districts to about 51% from about 55%, increased it marginally in another district, but did not create a second majority black district in that state. And so the question is, what happens next? Well, what happened next was, of course, the people petitioning for that enforcement of the Voting Rights Act took this back to the Court of Appeals, the 3-judge panel. And sure enough, the 3-judge panel said that the law requires the creation of an additional district. The Supreme Court has said that. We have said that. And this directive should afford black Alabamians, like everyone else, the court said, a fair and reasonable opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. The legislative plan, getting the 3-judge panel saying this, as did the Supreme Court, that plan plainly fails to do just that. So the 3-judge panel had said, you know what, because you've had multiple opportunities now to get this right, we're not going to send this back again to the legislature to make yet another stab at this. Instead, the 3-judge panel said this, going to appoint and have appointed a special master, a person to draw those lines on behalf of the legislature to do what the legislature has not done to comply with the law, and also hired a cartographer, a map drawer, a map person, who's going to come in likewise to assist that special master in drawing the lines in the way that the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals has directed them to do. What happened this past week? You would think at some point the legislature there in Alabama would say, all right, we have continued to lose this argument. We now need to simply comply with the rule of law, and we need to do what the law requires, the Voting Rights Act requires, as according to the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. Nope. The legislature this past week just filed an emergency application back to the United States Supreme Court Monday evening, asking the justices there to keep in place for now, that congressional map that they had drawn, based upon their view that it did in fact accomplish, if not by the letter of the lines, nonetheless, some approximate approximation of what the courts have said, plainly failing to establish that second majority black district or something close to it, according to the petition. Application means that the court is again going to be reviewing the role of its own work in this area, establishing voting districts for federal elections. It comes once again three short months after, in this surprise ruling, the court rejected this earlier iteration of the map that had diluted the power of black voters there. The request for emergency relief came in response once again to the appeals court, the three-judge panel saying, we're going to do this now or on our own. We're going to draw these lines for you. The special master will do it. The cartographer will do it, back in front of the United States Supreme Court yet again. And the Alabama legislature not taking its cues, more than its cues, its directives from the United States Supreme Court. We'll see where this goes. Presumably, the United States Supreme Court is going to make short shrift of this and say once again that they meant what they said. They said what they meant. Alabama simply got to do this. Interesting to see what the Alabama legislature will do once, presumably, the Supreme Court reaffirms for a second time that it meant what it said and said what it meant when it directed the creation of this second majority black district. Alabama, of course, a history of defying federal court orders and the rulings of the United States Supreme Court in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education way back in the 1950s, making a number of decisions, including one articulated by then Governor George Wallace, failing to desegregate the University of Alabama, ultimately compelled to do so by the Attorney General, by the President of the United States of America. Hopefully doesn't get to that, but the litigation continues in a case that should have been over 3 months ago. Look to another issue here that we have talked about only in passing, and that is something that happened last week, Saturday, right after we left the air here on the broadcast stations. You know well that Ken Paxton, the Attorney General of the state of Texas, had been impeached by the assembly there in the state of Texas, returned allegations that he had engaged in some serious fraud in connection with the operation of his office. Right after we left the air last week, the full Senate, having engaged in a full trial, found him not guilty of the allegations against him in those impeachment articles. And so Ken Paxton, returning to office immediately after that, charges of corruption, abuse of office. Significantly, the reason why this remains an issue, not only for the people of Texas, but for all of us, is that Ken Paxton is still not done with all of this. Even after his acquittal by the Senate in the state of Texas, he's still facing some very serious legal threats by a pending Justice Department investigation. In February, prosecutors said the department's looking into allegations made by whistleblowers that Ken Paxton extended some unusual help from his office to benefit a political donor. That person's name is Nate Paul, who's an Austin real estate investor. Mr. Paul had apparently paid for renovations to his house and employed a woman he was having an affair with, all as a result of his connections with Ken Paxton. All that being reviewed by the public integrity section of the U.S. Department of Justice. That also a key portion of the allegations in the impeachment articles. Again, the result of those, an acquittal coming out of the Senate just this past week. In addition, in June, federal prosecutors had charged Mr. Paul, this fellow who was again involved with Paxton, with making false statements to a financial institution, exaggerating the value of his assets, telling mortgage companies and credit unions they had more money than he did. And again, this case could provide some incentive for Mr. Paul to cooperate with federal government in the investigation of Paxton as this all goes ahead. So again, significant issues. still facing the Attorney General of the state of Texas. He faces charges, formal charges, that he solicited clients and investors from two companies while he was a member of the Texas House. Prosecutors in that case, this second matter still pending against him, said he misled investors in a technology company by soliciting about $600,000 in investments in 2011, but misrepresenting himself as an investor in that company. And again, failing to disclose he was making a commission on those investments. Lots of things involved in that pending case, that criminal case against Paxton for those kinds of involvements, investments in this technology company. That's still pending out there. Mr. Paxton now returning to position of responsibility and authority in the state of Texas, even while all of this is pending against him. We will continue to monitor all of that as well. We're going to see in just a moment or so some reverberations of that. What happens? What happens when you have an individual in an important position advancing the rule of law, responsible for government and for justice in America, who, yes, acquitted in this case of the political charges against him, but still facing some very serious legal problems, including charges, pending charges against him. What happens in those situations? What should happen? An awful lot of people calling for Ken Paxton to resign, even in the wake of his acquittal there. Probably not going to happen based upon statements that he articulated after his acquittal there in the state of Texas. But his continuing involvement in these cases, suggesting, again, he is presumed innocent, as all defendants are, of the charges against him, those that have been brought, those that may be brought down the road, but nonetheless suggesting that he should no longer be in this position, especially since, as the Attorney General of the state of Texas, what is he responsible for doing? Enforcing the law, which, again, is one of his principal focuses as the AG in that state. Very significant that should be going on in the state of Texas. We'll talk more about that in connection with another prosecution announced just this past week against a sitting senator, Bob Menendez. We'll chat about that in just a moment. Before we get to that, however, I promised as well we would return to the United States Supreme Court. We have not chatted about the Supreme Court in a number of broadcasts here. We're going to renew that focus on the United States Supreme Court in our broadcast of next week, just before the Supreme Court reconvenes in its new term, the 2023-2024 term, taking up right now about 23 cases. We'll probably add somewhere in the nature of about 40 more cases to that before it's all done. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about some important news coming out of the Supreme Court, not related to decisions, but once again, ethics. Stay with us for that discussion.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice of Wisconsin. I'm Terry Barr for the Civic Media Radio Network.
Don't let biased algorithms or degree screens or exclusive professional networks, or stereotypes. Don't let anything keep you from discovering the half of the workforce who are stars. Workers skilled through alternative routes rather than a bachelor's degree. It's time to tear the paper ceiling and see the stars beyond it. Find out how you can make stars part of your talent strategy at tearthepaperceiling.org. Brought to you by Opportunity at Work and the Ad Council.
The RPG came through the belly of the aircraft. We don't talk about the female combat wounded. These are our daughters and our sisters and our mothers. Wounded Warrior Project came into my life and taught me how to stand back up and get back in the fight. The truth is, I think we all have this strength inside of us, but until you're tested, you just don't know it's there.
See how Wounded Warrior Project empowers women veterans like Beth by visiting woundedwarriorproject.org/empowerwomenvets.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
This final segment of this, our first hour here on Morning Cannolis. Thank you for joining me this Saturday morning as we talk about issues in the areas of government and law and the aspiration for justice. We're back once again chatting about the United States Supreme Court because, yes, at least one, if not more, justices back in the news again as late as yesterday and the days before. We know we have talked a lot on this broadcast about some specific issues related to Justices Clarence Thomas and Sam Alito, having to do with their connections, their accepting gifts of travel, other things of value that may, in fact, and at least with respect to two pending cases, suggested that they should have recused themselves when it comes to decision-making. They failed to do that. A lot of things having to do with disclosures about their sources of income beyond their government salaries, trips they have taken, sponsored by individuals who may, in fact, have interests before the court, all of that suggesting that the United States Supreme Court needs desperately to have a code of ethics. We know from recent reporting from Capitol Hill as well that the Congress attempted to do just that. The Congress, specifically through the Senate Judiciary Committee and Dick Durbin, the chair of that committee, marked up, passed out to the main role of the United States Senate, a piece of legislation that would have established a code of ethics for the Supreme Court. That, of course, not getting a vote before the full United States Senate just because the votes aren't there, but attempts by the Congress to impose that ethics code upon the Supreme Court when the Supreme Court is itself failing to do just that. Well, once again, we know from this past summer or so that Clarence Thomas, making some financial disclosures, finally, responding in detail some reports that he had failed to disclose some luxury trips, flights on a private jet, and a real estate transaction with a Texas billionaire, that person's name, Harlan Crow, donated huge amounts of money to conservative causes. The Justice Thomas had amended some earlier forms that had inadvertently omitted some of the information that should have been there. He reported some trips taken over the past year on Crow's private jet. The first time in nearly two decades that he disclosed those gifts and travel. The form did not appear, however, to be comprehensive, did not include other things that we know are out there as well. Similarly, we know from a number of weeks ago that Sam Alito also acknowledged in his report that he had taken a flight on a private plane provided by a hedge fund billionaire during a vacation in 2008 to that fishing lodge in Alaska. All of that, the focus of some previous reporting. What happened just this past week? Just this past week, turns out, based upon some investigative reporting and some confirmation made by people who know about these things, that Clarence Thomas, once again, back in the news, that he twice attended an annual donor summit organized by a conservative political network that had been established by another billionaire, the billionaire industrialist Charles and David Koch. And that pretty much confirmed by the Koch Enterprises. He attended on two occasions, first invited there in 2008 to promote a memoir of his called My Grandfather's Son, and then to deliver remarks at a small dinner in 2018. The circumstances of that role in this donor event organized by this powerful right-wing organization, again, renewing these concerns, these focuses on ethics, again, many of them related to cases pending before the United States Supreme Court. A lot of people, again, viewing the connection to the Koch brothers as especially problematic. And why is that? Well, again, this is the aspect in which the present docket of the United States Supreme Court comes into play and is relevant to understanding all of this. There is a case pending in front of the United States Supreme Court, going to be argued sometime soon, called Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. We'll make reference to it next Saturday as well. Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. The question is, should some longstanding principles in which judicial deference is given to the expert interpretations and the determinations of federal agencies be abandoned? It's called the Chevron standard. It basically is an attempt to try to reduce the role of administrative agencies and civil servants in making all important decisions to keep our government up and running. And the Koch brothers, among others, have been principal advocates to get rid of that principle, this Chevron doctrine. And so it's significant not only that this case is pending before the Supreme Court, because it's pending, many people have called upon Justice Thomas, especially in the wake of this most recent news from just this past week about appearing at some of these Koch brothers' major network donor summits, calling upon the associate justice to recuse himself in that case. Plainly, he's not doing that, but the case is going to be argued again. And why is it significant? Well, it's because you've got this connection to the Koch brothers historically and presumably currently as well. Koch brothers plainly advocating for one of the central issues in this Raimondo Loper Bright Enterprises case. The case itself, one of the most significant that's going to be pending before the Supreme Court in this term, because once again, it's going to define the role of administrative agencies, not just with respect to the agency in that case. It's an agency called the Marine Fisheries Services, the National Marine Fisheries Services entity. It interpreted a regulation on payments for compliance monitors on fishing boats, believe it or not. But again, it has consequences far beyond that. Why? Why? Because if indeed the Supreme Court decides to overturn this 40-year-old judicial precedent, this standard in this case called Chevron versus NRDC, been out there again for four decades, basically saying that if there's some confusion, if the law isn't clear, the judiciary defers to the people who know well, defer to the expertise, the scientists, if you will, inside these agencies who know best because they do this all the time, deferring to the agencies appropriately to make government run. That notion, again, it has assisted and supported our agencies for four decades, frankly, even before that time of the specific articulation of Chevron, that continues to make our government work. And the Supreme Court has before it this case, Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo, in which they are raising the issue about whether or not that deference to federal agencies, deference to executive branch agencies should be abandoned going forward. The Koch brothers advocating for, again, this diminution in the agencies, what they call the administrative state out there. Again, the connection between the Supreme Court Associate Justice and the Koch brothers' advocacy and his reviewing this case, in which he will plainly have a vote. And again, presumably a split vote in the Supreme Court, and we can't predict for certain what's going to happen here. But we know that Clarence Thomas has that on his docket, as do the eight other members of the Supreme Court. All the more reason for him not to be entertaining this particular case. All the more reason to be concerned about the need for a code of ethics by the Supreme Court itself. Just this past week, perhaps in response to some of this latest news, in a public interview, Justice Elena Kagan has said that while she's not addressing the specific issues, she said to the Notre Dame Law School, "I would think I would go far in persuading other people that we were adhering to the highest standards, but suggesting that adopting a code would do just that." When we come back for our second hour, talking more about not just the Supreme Court, but other ways in which the rule of law is advanced, sometimes challenged in America, and the things that we can do to address those things in these United States of America. Stay with us for that discussion.
Cranberry juice, cranberry wine, cranberry brats, cranberry cream puffs. And excuse me, but my cranberry bread is ready. It's cranberry season in Wisconsin, and we're the cranberry capital of not just the U.S., but our farmers also produce more than half of the world's cranberry supply. So can you guess which state Wisconsin beat out to earn the number one spot? New Jersey? Washington State? Massachusetts? The answer coming up. Fall is harvest time, and you can see the machines rolling through the marshlands, which are flooded to help the cranberries float to the top. But it hasn't always been this easy. Back in the mid-1800s, the berries had to be picked by hand. It took another 100 years for the right equipment to be built to help with this harvest. Okay, so Wisconsin owns the cranberry capital title, but which state lost it to us? Massachusetts, which has been number two ever since. By the way, the cranberry is the official state fruit, making it a true slice.
You're listening to 93.5 The Tap, WCFW HD2 Chippewa Falls, W228 EP Eau Claire, and streaming everywhere on the Civic Media app.